Good evening. 2 weeks ago in Venice, close on 100 scientists of various kinds, astronomers, physicists, but mostly cosmologists, held a conference to celebrate the 60th birthday of that remarkable man, Fred Hoyle. The conference was called Frontiers of Astronomy 1975, and there are several things to say about it. First, it wasn't an old man's birthday, even if half the people there were once Hoyle's students, younger by a generation. In one way or another, everybody acknowledged that Hoyle was the most imaginative person among them. It wasn't so much a farewell to a grand old man, he isn't that in any case, as a chance to guess what he'd be up to next. Second, it wasn't a stuffy scientific conference, but the opposite. People asked questions openly and didn't bite off their tongues for fear that they might ask foolish questions. Third, it was a comradely conference. Hoyle has lots of friends, but also lots of enemies, who by their absence made the occasion seem a little conspiratorial. A group of like-minded people gathered in an Italian monastery to try to puzzle out what the future of astronomy will hold. So I put that question to Hoyle himself. What are the frontiers of astronomy 1975?
I think that the frontiers are connected with the structure of the whole universe, and that this is the problem that will occupy astronomers increasingly over the years ahead. Many of the past generation believed that they were very close to an ultimate structure for the universe, and that it was just only a question of time before the extra observational work, new observational work, would just fix the last final details. I don't believe this myself at all. I think what we see in the universe is only a tiny fragment of a much bigger structure, and that the bigger structure itself has a major influence on the physical laws, so that I think the future really lies in disentangling the part of the physical laws, which are the true laws, the symmetric, very true laws, from the environmental effects imposed by the universe.
This theme that cosmology and physics are inextricably linked together is what Hoyle has been saying for the past 30 years. It was, in a sense, the theme of the conference. And it's worth remembering that with this view, Hoyle has transformed our picture of what the universe is like, or may be like, more radically than anybody in the past half century, perhaps as radically as anybody in the past 300 years. Here's one tangible illustration. 30 years ago, at the end of the Second World War, astronomers knew that for most stars, there's a systematic relationship between its brightness, or its luminosity, and its color. The simple rule is, the more blue the star, the brighter. But nobody knew whether the blue, bright stars were old or young. And then there was another question that astronomers, as such, seemed not to bother about any more than the rest of us. Where did the elements come from? Why are metals like aluminium so plentiful? And why are metals like gold so rare? Not just in the solar system, but it seems everywhere. 30 years ago, people knew that stars get their energy from thermonuclear transformations, and it had, for example, been inferred that the sun keeps shining because it turns hydrogen into helium. In the early 1950s, Hoyle came along and solved both these problems at one stroke by showing that when a star has turned its original endowment of hydrogen into helium, it can then turn helium into carbon, at some later stage, carbon into aluminium and silicon, and eventually, silicon into iron. The result is that any star evolves through a succession of stages in which it consumes different materials as a source of energy. Hydrogen to begin with, then helium, and carbon, and so on. How quickly this process of evolution happens depends on the accident of how big the star was in the first place. The bigger the star, the faster the evolution. But if the star is big enough, It'll turn all its hydrogen eventually into iron. And then the time will come when the star itself explodes, in the process creating all the other elements, such as copper and uranium, that are heavier than iron. This material is scattered through interstellar space and eventually incorporated into solar systems like our own, which ties in well with what we know, that the Sun is a comparatively young star, less than half the age of the galaxy as a whole. So Hoyle and his associates explained how stars evolve in a way that also explains what astronomers know of different kinds of stars, and at the same time, where the elements come from. They're made of hydrogen. Hoyle is a controversial figure for reasons I'll explain, but all this is undisputed, and it's rationalized observational and theoretical astronomy. Now, there's more to be said about Hoyle's activities in the past 30 years. Just another example. He, with Professor Thomas Gold and Professor, now Sir, Herman Bondi, Chief Scientific Advisor to the Minister of Defense, was the inventor of the theory of continuous creation, the steady-state theory of the universe. The issue is simple. For the past half century, since it's been possible to distinguish in the sky galaxies outside our own, it seemed that the universe is expanding. That poses a dilemma. Is the universe really expanding, or is that an illusion? Philosophically, ever since Copernicus, it's been unfashionable in physics to suppose that there can be something about the universe that distinguishes here from there, or the present from the past or the future. And so it seemed natural to Hoyle and his associates to resolve the difficulty by supposing that matter is indeed continuously created. The universe is in a steady state. As time goes on, the galaxies we can see get further from each other, but now and again, new galaxies appear in the spaces left between them. As it's turned out, the theory of continuous creation has been, in the strict technical sense, a failure. It doesn't work like that. And it's fair to say that Hoyle wasn't the first to admit it. 15 years ago, he was at loggerheads with lots of people about this issue. But the idea that matter might be continuously created, simply the proposition of the idea, is such an assault on people's habitual way of thinking that all of us have been changed. The essential difficulty in cosmology, describing the universe in the large, is that of conceiving what changes must be made in our current view of what physics is like that are at the same time plausible, just barely acceptable, that is, and yet sufficient to provide the framework for a larger picture. I should add one comment. To assert that matter is created continuously is, of course, anybody's privilege. What Hoyle and company did was strictly within the rules of orthodox science. They worked with all the equations of general relativity, they made the mathematics come out, and in the process they accomplished feats of algebra that were in themselves remarkable. So it seems to me that there's a case for saying that even Hoyle's failures have been successes. They've changed the way that people think. As I've said, most of the people at the conference in Venice were collaborators or students of Hoyle's. They all acknowledged their debt to him. Here's Professor William Fowler from the California Institute of Technology, who with Hoyle and Professors Margaret and Jeffrey Burbage put together the first detailed theory of how the elements are synthesized. I asked him how he began his work with Hoyle.
Fred Hoyle walked into our laboratory one day in the early 1950s and made what we considered the ridiculous suggestion that we could, in our laboratory, study a peculiar property of the nucleus of the element carbon, which was of interest in connection with the production of carbon from helium in stars. I say ridiculous because this property involved a very short-lived form of the nucleus of the element carbon, which, however, could be produced as an intermediate state in the transfer from helium to carbon in red giant stars.
This, if I have it correctly, is the excited state of carbon-12.
This is what we call the excited state of carbon-12,
and Professor Whaling in our laboratory, in spite of jibes from the rest of us, took a look with our laboratory equipment, sure enough found the state that Hoyle had predicted, and that convinced us that this Yorkshireman had something on the ball and that we should listen to what he had to tell us. And he had many things to tell us. He had many things to tell us because, as is well known, among his many other activities, Sir Fred has made major contributions to the theoretical studies of the nuclear processes that take place in stars. We know that the sun is shining on energy that is derived from the nuclear processes that transform hydrogen into helium. What Hoyle did was open up a whole new vista to us, namely that after hydrogen had been converted into helium, the helium eventually reacted through this excited state of carbon-12 to form carbon. And he also laid the groundwork for the further reactions involving carbon and oxygen, building up all the time from lighter nuclei, the heavier nuclei, all the way up through the periodic table. So he showed us that there was a vast area where the practitioner, the experimentalist in the nuclear laboratory could, if he chose to do so, study in particular those nuclear processes that are thought to take place in stars in generating their energy and in essentially creating the elements.
Professor William Fowler, who's now mostly concerned with measuring in the laboratory the likelihood of nuclear reactions that may happen in stars. But even with accurate data, it's hard to calculate precisely what happens when a really massive star, perhaps 10 times more massive than the Sun, goes through its comparatively rapid evolution. This is obviously crucial to our present understanding of where the solar system came from. Dr. David Schramm, associate professor at the University of Chicago, has been working out the details, and I asked him what he's done.
The scenario that we were drawing was that all massive stars greater than about 8 solar masses, go to the state where their central core is about 1.4 solar masses, and then outside of that are layers of silicon, neon, oxygen, carbon, helium, hydrogen.
They've already run through, as it were, the early parts of their evolutionary history. They've become red giants.
Right. What happens is the star starts out as hydrogen, the hydrogen burns in the center to helium, and then the helium burns to carbon and so on, until eventually it gets to iron, which can no longer fuse together. There's no longer enough thermonuclear energy available, and since iron is the most stable of nuclear substances, and so there's a core of iron.
1.4 solar masses, you say?
Yes.
Now, what happens outside this iron core?
Outside the iron core are these shells of silicon, oxygen, carbon, and the relative abundances of these different shells, if this matter could be ejected in a supernova, agrees very well with the relative abundances of these elements in the solar system. And so this makes a very nice picture for the origin of the elements from, say, carbon to iron, if this matter can be ejected in a supernova.
Now, the outer shells of the star are still presumably producing some energy.
Yes, but at each boundary, nuclear reactions are taking place, producing more matter for the inner zone. So, for example, the silicon zone is burning to contribute more to the iron core.
Yes, so the iron core is growing bigger all the time.
Yes.
Now, is it entirely inert, or are things happening inside it?
Some very exciting things are happening, but no longer are nuclear reactions taking place. As the iron core gets bigger than 1.4 solar masses, the core begins to collapse. In addition, other things are taking place as well. What's holding up the iron core is degenerate electron pressure. But at these high densities, the electrons are being captured by the iron, so that removes some of the pressure. So that alone starts the collapse happening. Plus, the silicon burning to the iron adds more to the mass of the core. All of these things contribute to make the core begin to collapse. At the same time, these processes, for example, electron capture, produces neutrinos, and those neutrinos might be very important in the subsequent evolution of this core. The densities are so high that the electrons are being forced to be captured by the protons in the iron nuclei, converting them to neutrons. At the same time, the temperatures are so high that the iron is being broken up into free particles, neutrons and protons. Yet all the protons that are broken up to capture electrons and become neutrons. So what happens is the very center of the star is becoming very neutronized. So it's becoming a neutron star core with iron around it and then all these other things in subsequent shells outside of it.
Now, what do the neutrinos do?
Well, that's a point of great interest right now. The neutrinos generated in the core, which is neutronized, might be able to escape that core, but when they reach the iron region just outside of that neutronized core, they will interact with a very high probability. This may be just the kind of mechanism that would be necessary to blow off the outer part of the star, because the neutrinos could come from the interior region, pass through it, leaving the neutron star behind, then hit the high atomic mass iron and just push it right out like a piston, but a neutrino piston.
Dr. David Schramm with his picture of how massive stars explode. It ties in well with what we see of the Crab Nebula, a star that exploded 900 years ago. There's a cloud of debris still rushing out, but there's a neutron star left behind, the relic of Dr. Schramm's iron core. But this is only the nuts and bolts of cosmic evolution. What's happening to the universe as a whole? The issue here is much harder to define. Just now, the universe is expanding. That's why the light from distant galaxies is redder than it should be. But there's a physical point to be decided. Is it going to continue to be like this, or will the expansion at some stage stop? And will the universe then begin to contract again? In simple mechanical terms, it's a question of whether the matter in the universe at present is dense enough to hold everything together by means of gravitational self-attraction. Dr. Beatrice Tinsley, associate professor at Yale University, has been following this issue closely, and I asked her how it's turned out.
If we try to put together, for example, the direct measurements of density that can be made, I think they're probably the most compelling. The best guess of the result that you would get is that the density is probably less than 10% of the critical value that you would need to slow the expansion and stop it. In other words, the universe doesn't have enough matter and it will go on expanding forever. It's possible that there are great uncertainties in all this data, and of course each method that you try to use to estimate the density is a theoretical interpretation of some observations, and it might be possible within the uncertainties to raise this 10% to 30 or 50%, but it's very difficult to get a full 100% of that critical density.
Is it possible at all to measure the acceleration or deceleration of the expansion? Can that be measured directly, or does that
have to
be inferred?
Maybe I could refer to two methods that one can infer this deceleration. Directly related to the question of whether the universe will expand forever or will turn around and stop is, of course, how fast is it slowing down or decelerating now? If it wasn't slowing down at all now, then the age of the universe could be got just by measuring the present expansion rate and saying, if the galaxies were always expanding apart at the rate they are now, how long ago was the Big Bang? Mm-hmm. If the universe has been slowing down, then the time back to the Big Bang should be shorter than just that simple extrapolation. So one way of doing it is to make estimates of the age of the universe, in which you estimate the ages of the oldest stars and the galaxies and so on. Now, the usual method of measuring the deceleration, I mean, the more direct method than going through the ages, is to look at the very distant galaxies and see, as you look back in time, going out further into space, whether you can see the expansion rate substantially different from what it is now. And it's a very difficult measurement, because to get what you would predict to be any significant difference, you have to go a very long way out to very faint galaxies. If the simple models apply, then no matter whether the universe is open or closed, the only force is gravity, and the universe should be slowing down, which means that as you look back, you should see faster expansion speeds at a given redshift than you would if the expansion had been constant. If it was, that means faster in the past, so it's slower now, it's slowing down. Well, the latest data, which have been obtained at the Hale Observatories, and again subject to a lot of interpretation which one could argue about, are really very surprising, because when you put them together, it looks as though the expansion speeds were slower in the past than now, which means that the universe is accelerating, getting faster. And this just simply doesn't square with the simple models at all, because if the only force is gravity, it's got to be slowing down. This, though, is consistent with a modification that Einstein once tried to make to his own theory, the so-called cosmological term in the general relativity theory. So maybe we need to go back to that idea.
Is this a real intellectual puzzle? I mean, is it the kind of thing that puts people like yourself into a state of depression? Do you think that this is, in fact, a serious crisis for...
I don't think it's a serious crisis. It's an unexpected development in that relativity theorists working with Einstein's theory greatly prefer the theory without this extra term that would allow the universe to accelerate. The term is not disallowed, however, theoretically. It might in fact be telling us something fundamental about physics. But I think it's too soon to become excited about this as a fundamental discovery in physics until the astronomical observations and their interpretation have been worked on in all possible ways.
You made yourself this morning this arresting remark that perhaps we're asking the wrong questions of the universe. What did you mean by that?
I was saying that because if one takes each of these sets of data as seriously as they can be taken, without saying, well, maybe they're wrong for some enormous effect that we haven't yet thought about, there are real problems in terms of these new observations of the rate of deceleration. That, for example, the density of the universe that you get by looking at the distant galaxies, combined with this deceleration rate, gives you a very old age for the universe indeed. Maybe twice the age of the galaxies.
Yeah,
twice what we estimate for the age of the galaxy.
Something like 40 billion years rather than 20.
No, maybe 25 rather than 16, for instance. That isn't twice, but the uncertainties on the numbers I've said twice, maybe 1.5 times. At any rate, it means that just taking these numbers at face value, we would have to say that the galaxies were made many billions of years after the Big Bang, and that is theoretically difficult to understand. It also means that the density of the universe at the time of the Big Bang was rather more dense than we would like to believe if we want to understand some of the formation of elements that was going on in the Big Bang. But again, that can be got around by other theoretical adjustments. I made that remark about maybe asking the universe the wrong questions, partly because Fred Hoyle has always asked unorthodox questions. And for that reason, I felt, well, we shouldn't be afraid to introduce things like Einstein's cosmological constant again, if maybe the data are pointing in that direction.
But that's not a particularly radical thing to do, is it? I mean, did you have any other questions in mind?
I've gained the impression by talking to relativity theorists that they consider it to be radical, chiefly because Einstein himself, having invented this cosmological term, then repudiated it, because the reason why he put it into the theory was shown to be unnecessary. And it's somehow going against Einstein's own interpretation of his theory.
What Dr. Tinsley says is that, as since the time of Copernicus, the problem in cosmology is not so much to find the right answer to a specific question as the right question. The point about the cosmological term in Einstein's equations is this, that it goes some way to satisfy Mach's principle that the microscopic laws of physics should be determined by the structure of the universe as a whole. But it admits the possibility that our part of the universe may contract again. And so I asked Professor Martin Rees of the University of Cambridge what it would be like to live in a contracting universe.
The first and most obvious change which the astronomer would detect is that the present redshifts, interpreted as due to the recession of galaxies, would be replaced by a blue shift. The sky would then become much brighter. As the contraction proceeded, then the galaxies will, of course, approach closer together, and eventually one will reach a stage when the galaxies merge with one another, and one can no longer thereafter say that a star belongs to a particular galaxy. The universe would then, in effect, consist of, as it were, a gas of stars all moving independently. As the collapse proceeds even further, and I'm talking now about times a few million years before the collapse finally terminates, one would have a situation when the stars were moving almost at the speed of light, like the particles of a gas. One would think that the next thing to happen would be that the stars would tend to collide with each other. But before the density gets quite high enough for that to happen, the stars are affected because the radiation hitting their surfaces from outside, due to the integrated effect of all the other stars, becomes more intense than the radiation inside them, which is trying to leak out. In this situation, almost certainly the outer layers of a star will evaporate. At a later stage still, the pressure of the radiation becomes very important, and the whole of the universe attains conditions rather like those inside a collapsing star, which is eventually going to turn into a black hole. And one will end up with a situation rather like the time reversal of the Big Bang, from which most of us believe the present expansion started.
You mean the collapsing universe would really retrace the steps that people suppose to have happened since the beginning of our observable universe?
Yes, but the collapse would not be quite the mirror image of the expansion, because it would take place in a more irregular way. We believe the early stages of the Big Bang were fairly smooth, but during the collapse, the universe is very lumpy, and we expect that the collapse will therefore be very inhomogeneous. We expect also that all the radiation put out by stars throughout the whole cycle will be turned into thermal radiation, and you will end up with a universe with a much higher entropy than the universe had when it started expanding.
And then if it goes to a second cycle, as it were, of expansion and contraction, at the end of that, there'll be even more radiation left.
Yes, it's of course a tempting idea to imagine that the cycle of expansion and contraction is merely one cycle of a repetitive process, and you can then speculate about whether there were earlier cycles. It's important to emphasize that this is no more than speculation, because if we accept general relativity, it tells us that during the process of collapse, you get to the so-called singularity, when conditions become so extreme that we have no confidence whatsoever that our present laws apply. We can't even be sure that thermodynamics applies through a hypothetical bounce between one collapse phase and a subsequent expansion phase. But one reason why some people are interested in the idea of a collapse phase, which perhaps preceded the present expansion, is that it might provide an explanation of the so-called microwave background radiation we observe. As you know, the strongest piece of evidence for the Big Bang is that the universe is pervaded by microwave radiation with more or less a black body spectrum, which is believed to be a relic of the hot, dense early phases. And it is
getting cooler as the universe expands.
It is getting cooler as the universe expands. But there has always been a problem in accounting for the presence of this large amount of radiation. There are, in effect, 10 to the 8th, 100 million photons for every particle in the universe. And one idea which was suggested first by a Soviet group and has recently been discussed by Fred Hoyle is that one could attribute this radiation and the entropy corresponding to it to the radiation produced by stars and galaxies in a previous collapse phase.
You said that in the very first stages after a Big Bang, or in the interval between a collapse and an expansion, we can't be certain of the laws of physics. Is this, in fact, one of the preoccupations of people like yourself just now, to wonder how the laws of physics might differ in those circumstances?
Certainly. One thing which is really amazing is the extent to which it does seem possible to extrapolate the laws of physics determined terrestrially to far more extreme situations and situations remote from us in space and time. So far as we can tell, the laws of microphysics seem to be the same in the most distant galaxy as they are in the laboratory. Moreover, one of the alleged triumphs of the Big Bang theory is that it seems to predict that the material emerging from the Big Bang should consist of a mixture of hydrogen and helium in about the proportions observed in the present universe. And in making such a prediction, one has to assume that the laws of nuclear physics and gravitation, which are observed today, apply during a phase when the whole temperature of the universe was billions of degrees, which corresponds to a time when the universe was about a minute old, in the sense that only a minute had elapsed since the initial singularity.
So that's evidence that, in fact, the laws of physics may seem to hold really rather well, even in these extreme conditions.
It's suggestive evidence. One shouldn't press it too hard. And one reason why one shouldn't is that, of course, there are always many other alternative explanations for any phenomenon. The fact that we have not got any other satisfactory explanation for helium may reflect on the limited ingenuity of the theorists, rather than imply that the universe really was that way. But some people have been even bolder and have applied the laws of physics as we know them to even more remote epochs than the epoch of helium formation. Some people go back to the first microsecond or even earlier instance than that. And here, of course, the densities are so extreme that our uncertainty stems from our ignorance of the relevant elementary particle physics. Moreover, when you get still further back, you have to worry about more fundamental issues, such as the possibility that the gravitational fields and tidal forces are so strong that you can create particles, and at even earlier times still, one almost certainly would have to develop a full-blown quantum theory of gravitation, synthesizing general relativity in quantum theory. Some people believe that one will need to develop such a theory in order to understand why the present universe does possess this radiation in it, this microwave background, and also to understand why it is, on a large scale, so smooth and homogeneous, because what is amazing is not merely that the laws of physics apply universally throughout the parts of the universe that can be studied, but also that the expansion of the universe is remarkably smooth and regular, and can be described by a simple expansion rate which seems the same in all directions.
Professor Martin Rees's problem of the contracting universe ties in with Hoyle's most recent proposal, advanced earlier this year, of what the universe may be like. It goes like this. The universe that we can see is, first of all, only a part of a much larger structure, which we can't hope to see directly because of the way that space and time are puckered up in our locality. Light can't get in or out, so the different pieces aren't directly in communication with each other. So, even if our part of the universe is expanding, other parts, parts we can't see, may be behaving differently, contracting, for example. But near the boundaries, there are phenomena, black holes, for example, that involve two adjacent pieces of the universe. And in any case, microscopic physics in our part of the universe is determined by what's happening elsewhere in the parts we can't see. The fact that we have electric charges but no magnetic charges, for example. This has led to the idea that our part of the universe wasn't simply created in the Big Bang 15 or 25,000 million years ago, but that the Big Bang itself was really a kind of transition between a state in which our part of the universe contracted and then expanded again. And it's led to a detailed investigation of what might have happened in that process. Dr. Stanley Woosley from the California Institute of Technology has, for example, been working out what might have been done in the first 10,000 years or so of our present universe to create elements other than hydrogen and helium. I asked him to explain.
In the simple model, you make no heavy elements, and the reasons are well known, basically due to the lack of stable masses at mass 5 and 8, and the buildup of elements heavier than helium therefore takes place by predominantly three-body reactions, the triple alpha reaction, going to carbon and progressively higher elements. These are improbable in a low density phase of the universe. The low density is implied by the current conditions, but if the universe were inhomogeneous to a large extent, or if the mean density of the universe was much larger than we suspect from the current density, then you could have perhaps created heavier elements primordially. And one of the things I've been looking at is what the composition of such matter would be. It's very interesting what it comes out. You can't make elements lighter than iron. You can make helium and hydrogen, which you begin with, it's assumed. And you can make things above iron, but you can make nothing between helium and iron. And this has been known for some time.
And why is that?
Because the temperature is so high that having bridged this difficult region between helium and carbon, the carbon immediately captures alpha particles and goes directly into the iron peak, leaving very little between carbon and iron.
Do you go on after iron making still heavier elements in this?
Yes, you can. At the high temperature, the protons can actually add on to iron and go on and synthesize heavier elements. Usually, in the currently accepted theories, heavy element production beyond iron is attributed to neutron addition. But under the special conditions of a dense fluctuation in the Big Bang, you can actually make heavy elements by proton addition. Now, I must say that I'm not in any way hoping to claim that all of the elements which we see now were made primordially. I certainly believe the great bulk of the elements that we see in stars and that we're comprised of and which make up the solar system were made in stellar evolution, particularly in supernova explosions. But there may have been some contribution to the abundance of iron and heavier elements, which we see in very old stars, population 2 stars, that may be of primordial origin.
These are stars formed so long ago that there wouldn't have been time for them to acquire their full load of heavy elements from
supernova. That's right. They're very old stars, and if one presumes that the synthesis in stars and supernova has been going on over the course of the evolution of the galaxy, then these originated at a time before much nucleosynthesis had occurred in stars.
Dr. Stanley Woosley, with his argument that some of the stuff we see around us came not just from supernova explosions, but also from the earliest stages of the universe. But everybody agrees that these are speculative investigations. And as you've heard, Hoyle's theme is that there's still a lot to learn about the connection between astronomy and physics. So how are the cosmologists going to work out what laws apply to the universe as a whole? Fred Hoyle.
It's not at all easy from the part we see. I suspect that it will turn out that the details which the particle physicist discovers in the lab, mass differences between particles of a similar kind, for example, the 8 baryons, that they tell us more about a bigger structure for the universe than the astronomer is observing, very much bigger.
So that in a sense you see a coming together of these studies in fundamental high-energy physics on the one hand and observational and theoretical astronomy on the other.
Experience has shown that the big advances in astronomy come when they are related to a big advance in physics. And I think the problems that the particle physicist is studying or struggling with will be very relevant to cosmological studies. I would like to say that if you go back to the Greeks, they believed that the planetary motions could be explained as some aesthetically perfect shape constructed out of circles. And no matter how many complexities came along in the succeeding 2,000 years pretty well, they continued to adhere to this belief. Whereas we know today that while the planetary orbits certainly satisfy a very elegant basic law, there is nothing special about the fine details of the orbits, about their elements and about the planetary masses and so forth. These are what I might call excrescences imposed on the solar system. In another planetary system, we would expect all those features to be different, although the same laws would be satisfied. And in a somewhat similar way, I think the precise details that the physicist discovers, for example, the difference between the mass of the proton and the neutron, things of that kind, these are excrescences due to the environment.
Concealing a fundamental symmetry.
Concealing a much more fundamental symmetry.
And are you implying that the Greeks were right in expecting the universe to be a highly symmetrical structure, or at least the laws governing its behavior to be highly symmetrical?
I think they were the aesthetic quality lies in the laws, not in the form.
And how is this going to show up in practice? I mean, what, for example, would you expect future of this question? What will happen to the universe as time goes on? How will that, as it were, be determined by these considerations?
I think we shall find it difficult to arrive at a unique answer for the whole universe because we only see a part of it. And if what I'm saying is anyway right, only a very small part. And there may be many structures which would give the same results for a small part. So just by looking, it may be very difficult to infer what the universe is like on a big scale. But I think we will be able to deduce certain very general results, which have to be true in any case. And one of the results which I suspect to be true is that there is a closure condition wherever you are. That's to say, it doesn't matter where you are in the universe, you are essentially inside a piece of it, which shows the properties of, if you like, at one place, of the properties we associate with a Big Bang, and at another place, the properties that we associate with collapsing into a Big Bang. and that this is the essence of the whole matter, that the universe is divided into these regions. The position we're at the moment is to ask the question, how many features of the things we observe are due to the adjacent piece, which hasn't previously been considered by astronomers at all?
An adjacent piece which is not observable in the ordinary sense.
Which is not observable in the ordinary sense, but we do have things that we observe that are derived from it, as, for example, the microwave background.
And the idea that the universe, or the super-universe, perhaps one should call it, is inhomogeneous in this way, is of course novel, also a bit shocking, isn't it? And it goes quite against the
I think it goes totally against the standard point of view. It's a bit like Van Munchausen's fox, which is pulled inside out. When one says, well, the physical laws, the differences between particles and so forth, relate to a bigger structure. We think of physics as relating to the small, and astronomy is relating to the big, whereas what I'm saying now turns that inside out. Astronomy relates to something which is big by ordinary standards, certainly, but which is maybe very much smaller than the regions that affect the form of physics.
To take the particular issue of the microwave background, you said that this may be one of the signs we have of what's happening in the other pieces of the universe. How might it in practice arise? I mean, what kind of model might one put to that? Is it the relic of...
Well, what I've tried to do is something very well defined, but it may not be the correct solution to the problem, but at least it's a well defined problem. And to say, the other piece look very much like our piece, and since we know what our piece looks like, that tells us something about the other piece on that hypothesis. And then to say, well, this collapses into the Big Bang state, and so we know the form of the state preceding the Big Bang, and we can infer what comes through it. And in that way, I've been able to make certain deductions, of which one was to ask that certain compositions of nuclei between atomic weights 60 and 80 be computed, and you saw for yourself how good the results were for elements like copper and zinc, for which we've always found it very difficult to understand an origin in terms of stars.
This theory now is the one that you published earlier this year.
That's right.
What you're suggesting is that in our local piece of the universe, as it were, the piece we can now see, there was previously an expanded state which collapsed, went through this rather traumatic period of the Big Bang, and is now expanding again. Similar or inverse processes may be happening elsewhere in the universe.
That's right. All over the place, similar effects. But this was one of the tests. The talk I gave, to which the young man Woosley referred, I kind of wrote up on the board all the possible things that one might look for to check this point of view, and one of them was the composition, the precise composition of these nuclei. As he said afterwards, he set himself to do this because he had a computer program that was very close to being in shape to solve the problem, and he found, as you could well see, that
all these heavier elements
at a first shot with rather not too good nuclear data, not as good as we're used to having, that things came out pretty well.
But presumably this same calculation could have been made with a standard Big Bang origin for the universe.
No, not at all. No? Because they would not have had the correct density fluctuations, and if they decided to put density fluctuations in ad hoc, they would not have known how much to make them. They would not have had a value.
Yes. Density fluctuations, as it were, the dense places in which the heavy elements are manufactured efficiently, these come out directly from the pre-existing.
That's right. You simply take stars and see what happens to the star as it goes through this, and that tells you what the density fluctuation should be.
And a star in the previous stage of the universe becomes the origin of these density fluctuations.
That's right.
Actually cook the elements. Mm. So that really, in a sense,
they cook a certain band of elements,
indeed,
we've always had difficulty.
Yes. Nothing that you've said denies the fact that the supernovae actually generate elements as the galaxy or the...
Oh, none at all. And the...
It's just an addition.
The evidence that we now have about the existence of anomalous grains of solid material in the solar system are clearly derived from stars, those grains.
Now, in a curious way, what you've been able to do is to construct a picture of what happens in the super universe that really retains the intellectually attractive features of the steady-state theory. The attraction there was that it did actually make it possible to think of a universe without a specific beginning, without a specific end. And that, this is true.
That is absolutely true. It does remove the logical problem of the beginning, which really doesn't make too much sense. It's very metaphysical, that's to say, outside physics. All that goes by the board, and one has a more sensible description of the situation. That's right, but the old steady-state theory came out of an idea which really was held by scientists, in particular by Einstein, from the beginning of the present century. What happened was, dating from the time of Mach, many scientists believed that there was a connection between the universe and the physical laws. Having started with that belief, they then added to that the idea that the physical laws are everywhere the same. They came to that point of view. But if the physical laws are coupled to the universe and the physical laws are everywhere the same, that means the universe must be everywhere the same. So it was that motivation which led Einstein in his first cosmological model to a model that was entirely static, that never changed.
Yes.
Well, when the redshifts of the galaxies were discovered observationally, it was clear that that point of view, that particular model for the universe was not correct. And this led to the Friedman models, where the universe is changing, but the laws are not. So the older view is now seen to be collapsing. But what happened in the case of the steady-state theory is that we managed to put together a theory where the universe was allowed to change quite consistently with the observations as it seemed at that time, but to retain the idea of this connection dating
the laws of physics were the same.
That's right, because of the steady state condition. So that was the motivation. But I think now one would go to a much more radical theory in which, over large volumes of the universe, and by large I mean large compared to what we actually see with a big telescope, the laws of physics do change, but not in their basic structure, but in what I call these additional environmental effects due to the universe.
The past 30 years have really been exceedingly exciting in astrophysics, largely because of work that you yourself have started. Are the next 30 years going to be as much fun?
I don't think that's an entirely scientific question, if I may say so. I think it's bound up with social factors. We are, from a social point of view, very similar to the Depression days now. And one just doesn't know what's going to happen, whether it's going to get worse or whether it's going to get better.
And you mean it may perhaps sap people's morale?
That's right. The universe is very rich, and I don't see the next 30 years being any less interesting than the last 30 years.
Sir Fred Hoyle's program for the next 30 years in cosmology won't appeal to everybody. Some will say, why go looking for trouble, supposing that what we think of the laws of physics are just a kind of accidental consequence of the piece of the universe in which we happen to be? Philosophically, Hoyle's a Pythagorean, always on the lookout for more perfect symmetries. But he's also a Machian, convinced that microscopic and macroscopic phenomena are united. But like the old steady-state theory, the mere idea that what we now think of as the accessible part of the universe is just a piece of a larger whole has set people thinking on new lines. Even if Hoyle's wrong, his new theory will be worthwhile, which is why he's so many people's hero. And he may, of course, be right. Good night.